Hello, I'm Greg Stone, and we're here at the annual scientific sessions of the American College of Cardiology in New Orleans, where we're going to be discussing prevention of sudden cardiac death in high-risk patients after angioplasty, specifically those with acute myocardial infarction. And we've made, over the last two decades, tremendous advances in patients with acute myocardial infarction with primary angioplasty, significantly enabling reductions in mortality, reinfarction, recurrent ischemia, and basically improvement of quality of life. However, there are significant numbers of high-risk patients who present particularly with left ventricular dysfunction who have a high incidence still of sudden cardiac death and mortality even after successful primary angioplasty. And I'm here with my esteemed colleagues, Jim Hermiller from the CARE Group in Indianapolis, Alan Kadish from Northwestern, and Sunil Rao from Duke. And we're going to discuss this further, specifically looking at electrical therapies to be able to prevent sudden cardiac death. So let me kind of start the discussion, gentlemen, by talking about some observations we made several years ago in acute myocardial infarction from the Cadillac trial. And this was one of the largest primary PCI trials, and it was a study of over 2,000 patients. They were randomized to different antithrombotic regimens and angioplasty versus stents. But the bottom line is, when we looked at the overall outcomes of those patients, they did very, very well. We could still identify high-risk groups, and we came up with a Cadillac risk score that we published in JACC. And there were four clinical and three angiographic variables that predicted high-risk patients: advanced age, presentation with Killip class 2 to 4, that is, in heart failure, renal insufficiency or anemia, and then in the cath lab, multivessel disease, depressed left ventricular ejection fraction, and the inability to restore TIMI 3 flow. And we could stratify patients into low, intermediate, and high-risk groups, and those patients who were at high risk, even though we enrolled a low-risk population, and 95% of whom had a successful primary angioplasty, 15% of them died within a year in the high-risk group, most of whom died within 30 days, about 60% of whom died suddenly. We also know that with primary angioplasty, when you have big infarcts, what we don't do a great job is salvaging myocardium. And that's because patients often come in too late for us to help them there. So we end up with still big infarcts. By getting the artery open, by treating them carefully, putting them on good medical therapy, we can prolong their lives. But we still have a high-risk group that we've got some great opportunities to intervene on. So that brings us to the question of what to do when we've identified a high-risk patient group for sudden cardiac arrest. And we know that implantable cardiodefibrillators, or ICDs, significantly prolong life in general in patients with left ventricular dysfunction, but not necessarily in that group early. So, Alan, I'd like you to kind of review for us what are the current indications for ICDs and focus in general and then specifically in the post-MI population.
Sure. Patients who've had a cardiac arrest or an episode of sustained ventricular tachycardia are indicated for defibrillator therapy unless it happens immediately in the setting of an acute myocardial infarction. But the larger group, and the group that's more complicated, particularly post-PCI, is patients who've not yet had a cardiac arrest or sustained VT, so-called primary prevention of sudden death. We know in patients with chronic coronary disease, patients who have an ejection fraction under 30% or under 35% in the presence of heart failure have an indication for ICD therapy, and it's been shown that ICD prolongs life in those groups of patients. In contrast, a study that attempted to put ICDs in the subacute phase of myocardial infarction, say 7 days after myocardial infarction, was unable to show that ICDs prolong mortality.
This is the DYNAMITE study.
And this is the DYNAMITE trial.
Right.
And the reasons that the ICD did not prolong life when put in immediately or soon after myocardial infarction are still not completely understood, but they seem to relate to two factors. One is that the patients who die suddenly also have a high incidence of dying for other reasons. But the other reason may be that defibrillator implantation soon after myocardial infarction may actually have deleterious effects.
Right.
Therefore, because of the results of the DYNAMITE trial, the official indications for ICD implantation exclude patients within 40 days of myocardial infarction, which was the enrollment period in the DYNAMITE trial. So within the first 40 days, there's pretty good evidence that an implantable defibrillator won't prolong life In contrast, after 40 days, if the ejection fraction is still down below 30 or 35, there's good evidence that the ICD will prolong life.
But isn't that those first 40 days or that first month the highest risk period for sudden cardiac death?
It is, and that really gets to the question you asked before, is what do we do with those patients? We don't really have great risk stratification techniques other than the Cadillac score that you described. And in terms of arrhythmias, we know from other studies that the most important risk factor for arrhythmias is left ventricular dysfunction.
Right.
We do have a temporizing therapy that we can use aside from best medical therapy in the first 40 days after myocardial infarction, and that's the wearable cardioverter defibrillator.
Right, and we'll come to that. So, but if I can summarize, so as us, our group as interventional cardiologists, we've got some opportunities here. If we see a patient in the cath lab that we're doing an intervention on or just a diagnostic cath, and their left ventricular ejection fraction is less than 30 to 35%, so they have a chronic cardiomyopathy, but not in the acute MI setting, then we should at least strongly consider for those patients an electrophysiology consultation to see if they're appropriate for ICD implantation.
Exactly.
On the other hand, if they are in the acute infarct setting, we've taken them to the cath lab for a primary angioplasty, we can identify the high-risk patient, but we can't, at least it's not appropriate at this time, to consider implantable ICD implantation in those patients within about 40 days. Now, Sunil, that's, you know, it brings up a frustration level because we see these patients, we have an occluded LED, we open it up, the ejection fraction is 20%. We know that patient's probably got about a 5 or 7% chance of sudden cardiac death in the next month. And I think that people are putting defibrillators in that situation. In fact, there was a recent study that was published in JAMA that got a lot of attention from the NCDR that showed that about 22% of ICD placements were, quote, inappropriate according to the guidelines. Can you tell us about that study?
Yeah, sure. I think you summarized it well, and it certainly has been a lightning rod for a lot of controversy within the clinical community, I think particularly within the electrophysiology community. And I think it's important when talking about those types of studies that, you know, the data need to be, that we're collecting for these kinds of registries needs to be a little bit more granular because we need to understand why some of these patients receive these defibrillators. And I think, you know, while it may be inappropriate according to guidelines, there may have been very good clinical reasons, many of which you outlined, for these patients to receive them. But the other issue I think also is that, as you mentioned, there is a quantifiable risk of sudden cardiac death in that post-MI period. The problem, I think, is really twofold. One is that we as interventional cardiologists that's not on our radar screen and probably should be in the acute MI setting, particularly as patients are recovering from their primary angioplasty. But the other issue is that, you know, it's difficult, I think, to identify who those patients specifically are. So while the registry data may tell us that it's, quote, inappropriate, there may have been clinical reasons that simply aren't captured within the data to try and treat this high-risk group of patients. Now, you mentioned that we're going to talk about the life vest, yeah. And that may be a nice middle ground
right.
while we're waiting for better risk scores and better risk identifiers to be developed.
All right, so short of some sort of electrical interruption therapy, we're going to treat these patients with ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers. We're going to treat them with beta blockers. Amiodarone, Alan, as an electrophysiologist, is there a place for prophylactic amiodarone?
That's been well studied. Amiodarone really does not improve survival in post-MI patients or in patients with chronic disease, primarily because the antiarrhythmic effect, such as it is offset by the toxicity of the drug. So there's no indication for prophylactic amiodarone to prevent sudden death. One thing I just want to add to what you said about the study of inappropriate ICD implantation is I want to make it clear that the guidelines very clearly state that if you've got a patient who has an episode of sustained VT or VF or comes to the hospital with a very minor enzyme leak, that does not exclude
yes.
from having an ICD within the next 40 days. So it's very important to say that.
Now what about in a large infarct? A large infarct with primary VTVF.
Right. A large infarct with primary VTVF within the first 24 hours, you probably don't need to worry about that patient to a major extent.
Right.
But if it happens after 24 hours, that's an indication for the secondary prevention of sudden death with defibrillator implantation.
Okay. I would echo one of Sunil's comments that as interventional cardiologists, we too often think we put a stent in, this patient's fine, and really don't think about this risk of sudden death, which is so high within the first month, 6 weeks.
Right. So Jim, you've gotten experience with a wearable ICD, if you will, not an implantable, but a wearable cardio defibrillator, which is the Life Vest. Can you describe this for us and then tell us what your experience has been?
Right. So the Life Vest is a basically wearable defibrillator, cardioverter for sustained VT and also VF, and easy to wear by patients. They tolerate it very easily, anterior and posterior defibrillator pads with gel that's sort of activated at the time that they need to be shocked. It's able to record that rhythm, so you really have a recording of what happened during it. And actually, there's a warning to that patient that if, in fact, they're going to be shocked, and this is an inappropriate shock, which is relatively very rare and infrequent, they're warned and they can really shut the vest off with a button. I think we'll talk about the reliability of it and its ability to detect these arrhythmias, but it's been something that's well tolerated by patients. And,
so it's comfortable. They sleep in this thing?
They sleep in this thing.
Okay.
You know, on average, they wear it 22 hours a day, and so it's well tolerated. I think particularly the patient that comes in with the risk factors that you talked about, big anterior infarct, particularly when there's, to me, non-viability, whether that's MRI or, you know, they've come in late, you don't get good reperfusion. Those are the patients that I've used this in.
Right. And one of the reasons for waiting these 40 days as well is that some patients will improve their left ventricular function over time. So you'd like to avoid a permanent implantable device if 1 month later their ejection fraction is going to go from 30% up to 50%.
Right.
And that does happen with primary angioplasty, especially when you get them early.
Yeah.
So there have been studies with the wearable cardio defibrillator, the Life Vest, and Alan, maybe you can tell us about those.
The larger study was a description of the manufacturer series for 4 years, which included over 3,500 patients. There were a number of different categories of patients who got the wearable cardioverter defibrillator, some who had infected defibrillators where it was extracted, but there were significant numbers of patients post-myocardial infarction who were within the period where ICDs weren't yet indicated because of exactly the factors you just mentioned, Greg. So in those patients, the defibrillator was highly effective at converting VT and VF. It was well tolerated in most patients, but not all, because some of my patients just have refused to wear the device. So there are improvements we can make, and I don't want anyone to feel that everybody can tolerate the device. But most patients can, most patients wear it, and it's highly effective. The one weakness it has is, unlike an implanted defibrillator, it doesn't serve as a pacemaker. And so there was a significant incidence in that series of 3,500 patients of asystole causing sudden cardiac death, which, of course, was not helped by the wearable defibrillator.
Right.
But except for that caveat, it's a very effective device. And what you can do then is reevaluate the patient 40 days after the primary angioplasty, see if the ejection fraction is still depressed or if you've been successful at salvaging myocardium.
Right.
And if the EF is still down, you can then convert the wearable defibrillator to an implanted defibrillator. The wearable defibrillator really is not a 6-12 month device, but it's very good for 30 to 60 days.
And it is compatible with pacemakers. So patients who do have permanent pacemakers, you can still wear this.
Exactly.
Okay. Is this covered by insurance? Is this paid for? How do patients cover this device?
So it has been paid for.
Yeah.
The insurance companies, sometimes you need to argue a little bit with them and get it covered. But it has been in the patients that we've used it.
That's been my experience as well. Most insurance companies now will pay for it, particularly when you juxtapose the cost of the wearable defibrillator to a permanent implanted ICD and tell the company you may be able to save implantation of a permanent ICD in people who don't really need it by using the wearable defibrillator.
Yeah.
So how common are inappropriate shocks with this device, and how uncomfortable are the shocks compared to an ICD shock?
Yeah, so they're very uncommon. I think from the series that we just talked about, very low number, 1-2% overall, so quite low. Again, the patient can inactivate the device if they're told it's coming and it's going to be inappropriate, then they can hold it off. So it's quite infrequent.
Okay. So Sunil, I can imagine other situations. I mean, this, I think, has been a great discussion, because I think as interventionalists, we need to think about this for our patients at high risk for sudden death in the early phase after acute myocardial infarction. I mean, there have been no randomized trials with the Life Vest yet in that setting. It would be nice to have that, but this certainly seems like a low-risk alternative that a certain reasonable, very strong hypothesis-generating concept to consider this in very high-risk patients. There are other patients, for example, those who have had a recent lead extraction, let's say for lead sepsis or other indications, in whom for a month or two may not be able to get an ICD placed back in. Those patients are at very, very high risk. patients post-surgery with poor left ventricles. They have to wait 3 months, according to the guideline, before an ICD is put in. New diagnosis of idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy or class 4 heart failure who don't have CRT therapy. There's a lot of other indications for ICDs that aren't currently supported by the guidelines officially that we might consider in this. Are you using this at Duke, and would you consider this type
of device? Well, I think you bring up some really good points. I mean, we probably should be using it more at our center, probably like other centers. And I think, you know, you bring up the patients who are probably really good candidates, but I think there's also a group of patients in whom we probably should be studying a little bit more. You know, patients who undergo high-risk PCI, maybe for ischemic cardiomyopathy and poor left ventricular function, who've not had a recent MI, that, you know, as a bridge to ICD placement. And I think in the era of, you know, sort of everyone looking over our shoulder, and as these sort of these papers come out saying that certain things that we're doing are inappropriate, to have an option like this is very valuable. And, you know, as I mentioned, we probably should be using it more than we are, and that's an education issue, really.
Yeah. I want to go back to the issue of the inappropriate ICD implantations that you talked about and the potential role of the life vest. Almost all of these, quote, inappropriate ICD implantations were a timing issue. The largest group, actually, was not the post-PCI patients, although that was a significant group, but it was actually the patients with recently diagnosed cardiomyopathy. Right. And those patients actually, unlike the post-MI patients, where at least we have one or two randomized studies which show that the implantable defibrillator is not helpful, in patients with recently diagnosed cardiomyopathy, either ischemic or non-ischemic, there's actually no data that the ICD is not helpful.
Right.
The guidelines just don't say you should put an ICD in because there are no data from randomized trials that are helpful. We actually published a retrospective analysis of a trial in non-ischemic cardiomyopathy that showed that ICDs actually are helpful within the first 90 days because there was a very high incidence of sudden death in patients with recently diagnosed cardiomyopathy.
Although some of those patients might reverse, right? If it was myocarditis, if it was acute alcohol or cocaine use, I mean, some of those will reverse. So there's a reason to wait, especially given the cost and occasional complications of an ICD.
Exactly. And that's why I was really saying that because the timing issue is so important, this controversy, I think that the wearable defibrillator is a very good choice for patients that you're worried about in any of those timing categories where the indications don't quite yet support the use of an ICD, but the wearable defibrillator is an option. The other thing I would say is that I don't want to overemphasize inappropriate defibrillator implantation in those groups of patients where it hasn't been shown that the defibrillator is not helpful. I think there still ought to be a role for clinical judgment, and I think that if you have a bridging option, it really helps you exercise that clinical judgment in the best possible way.
Well, you know, and I think that term inappropriate has been overused because this report from Al-Khatib in the NCDR was over 100,000 defibrillator implantations, and the lowest rate was down at around 6% of, quote, inappropriate use, and the average rate was up at around 20%. Right. So, and it was less likely for inappropriate use to be performed by electrophysiologists compared to non-electrophysiologists, but even electrophysiologists had a, quote, 20% or 21% inappropriate rate. So I think, you know, physicians need to be able to practice the art of medicine. They're using their best judgment in high-risk patients. There may certainly be mitigating factors. Guidelines are just guidelines. They're not rules. But nonetheless, we also know about the high cost of defibrillators, and this is one of the biggest ticket items in the Medicare budget every year. And given that in some of these newly diagnosed heart failure patients, the post-bypass surgery patient, and the post-primary PCI patient, anywhere from 30 to 60%, the ventricles will improve over time, and they won't have an indication 2 months or 3 months later for an ICD. So I think this temporary external wearable cardiodefibrillator is a good option for those patients. So, any closing comments?
Yeah, I would just, maybe not a closing comment, but the role of the interventionalist as these patients who have indications for ICDs now, or you think in 3 months, we in some way are gatekeepers. Often they'll come through us, and unless we sort of get them to an electrophysiologist or think about a life vest, these patients aren't going to get it. They're going to go back to their cardiologist and sort of be missed in the system. So I think we all need to be, I think, as interventionalists, more aware of this sudden cardiac death issue, and whether it's life vest or getting them to an EP specialist, it needs to be on our radar.
Yeah. So, Alan, last words?
Well, I would echo what Jim just said, which is that we've made a lot of progress at prevention of sudden death as a society. We've done a lot of good things about limiting the size of MI with PCI. We've changed lifestyle so that the incidence of coronary disease hopefully is no longer increasing. We've put automatic external defibrillators in.
Yep.
But there are still several hundred thousand sudden deaths a year in the United States, and many of those are indeed patients who do have indications from implanted defibrillators. And the problem of inappropriate defibrillator implantation is actually much smaller than the problem of patients who have indications for defibrillators, who may benefit from them, who don't get them. So the idea of the interventional cardiologist being a gatekeeper and thinking about this issue, I think, is a very important one.
Sunil?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's already been said, but I agree with what Jim and Alan have said. I think really the onus right at this point in the patient's care is really on the interventional cardiologist to not just think about reperfusion and door-to-balloon times and the kinds of things that we're obsessed with, but also start thinking about that period of time between the primary PCI and the time that they go home and the time that they may be candidates for an ICD. And that's going to be probably the most important thing with respect to reducing the risk of sudden cardiac arrest.
Right. So I agree. Certainly as an interventional cardiologist, it's wonderful to be thought of as a gatekeeper. But many of these patients will present in different care settings. I mean, many are referred directly to bypass surgery, for example, and then those are patients that we have to consider. Many will end up in heart failure clinics after an outside diagnostic cath showed in clean coronary arteries, for example. So I think that this is really a cardiology/medicine-wide issue. And I think we need greater dissemination of these options for patients. And finally, it's very clear that we need more study. And it would be great to have, I think a perfect setting would be primary angioplasty, using the Cadillac risk score as to identify high-risk patients, and then randomize those patients, frankly, to either the life vest or control. And I think that with enough patients and an appropriate trial, my hypothesis would be that we would show a reduction in cardiac death and or sudden cardiac death and or total mortality. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's very little downside, very few side effects of this device, which of course makes it very, very attractive. So what we've tried to do over the last 20 minutes is review some of the causes of sudden cardiac death and some of the most common patients that we see in cardiology today. And while we've made tremendous progress, we still have more ways to go. On the other hand, we do have new options. In particular, there's no doubt the implantable cardiodefibrillator, when used in appropriate patients, saves lives. We now have a second option, the external wearable cardiodefibrillator, for patients whom are not yet indicated, according to national guidelines, for permanent ICD placement. And we'd like all viewers of this program to at least, I think the four of us certainly agree, that that should be considered when you're taking care of these high-risk patients. Thank you very much.